Perhaps the greatest contribution that James Madison made to our constitutional form of government was something called the separation of powers. Three different branches of government designed to prevent any one branch or any of the people in any one branch from becoming too powerful. But from time to time, people wonder whether James Madison divided things up a little bit too much. In fact, he made the national government not nearly as powerful as it needs to be because, to borrow a phrase, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And sometimes our national government, perhaps right now, doesn't seem to be functioning well. That's why recently at Montpelier, we had a summit, and we talked about Congress, the separation of powers, and even a bit about the judiciary. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's all about Congress.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Paul Michel is a retired chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. That's a pretty important job and gave Paul a really interesting perspective on how the national government functions. Lauren Bell is a dean at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia. She focuses on Congress, and she has a lot to say about Congress and how it fits into our federal structure as well. Recently, the two of them were out at Montpelier for something that the folks at the Center for the Constitution like to call a Montpelier Summit. It's one of their on-campus educational programs. People come in and stay there for several days, and they talk about things. But the Montpelier Summits are not about strictly academic or historical subjects. They're about how do we make the government function better today? And the answer is we teach the people who are in government about the Constitution. I was at Montpelier that weekend and sat down with Paul and Lauren in the new Potter Studios at the Center for the Constitution.
My name is Paul Michel. I'm a retired federal appeals court judge. I'm interested in trying to spread the gospel of constitutionalism to the new generations that will soon be running the United States.
Well, Judge, whenever I meet a judge, I find it difficult to call them anything but judge. In fact, it's been my experience that when you ascend to the bench, that somehow your first name changes to judge. But when I met you today, you immediately wanted me to call you Paul, so I'll call you Paul if that's all right.
Very good.
But a very impressive background. That's one step below the United States Supreme Court.
It is, and it was a great honor to serve there for 22 years, the last 5.5 as the chief judge. I also had the pleasure of being on the executive committee, as it's called, of the Judicial Conference, the governing body of the federal judiciary. That's a 7-judge committee that sort of runs the court system in between the twice-a-year meetings of the full 26-judge judicial conference. So in addition to being responsible for my own little appellate court based in Washington, I also had some role in helping to manage the nationwide system. I learned a lot.
You did. In fact, isn't it the judicial conference that through a committee actually promulgates the federal rules of civil procedure and appellate advocacy and all that sort of thing?
It is, in effect, the decision maker. The Congress and the Supreme Court have veto power, but it's virtually never exercised. So the judicial conference acting on the recommendation of its rules committee is the effective decision maker. And that was another interesting role to play.
Very, very important. And I don't want to bore people and get too technical, but one of the subjects I happen to teach is civil procedure. And so the federal rules of civil procedure and how they are promulgated and the advisory committee notes and all of that arcana are things that I bore my civil procedure students with every year. But I have a saying that I like to use: time spent reading the rules is never wasted. And I've had students 10 years later send me that back, that statement back, and say you were so right. I mean, that if the difference between a competent lawyer and a really great lawyer is the one who knows the rules the best. It really is true. And so now I'm meeting a guy who was running the whole thing. This is a big day for me.
You know, I think the various rules, evidence rules, criminal rules, civil procedure rules that you mentioned, are really one of the great inventions of America. Obviously, the Constitution first and foremost, but the federal rules are way up there in the panoply of great inventions that have lasted well and been, I think, highly effective and provided necessary grooves for the the country to run on.
I could not agree with you more, and we may return to that before too long. But before we do that, I've been rude. We have a lady with us, and I did not look at her first when I asked, who are you and what do you do? And who are you and what do you do?
I'm Lauren Bell. I am professor of political science and dean of academic affairs at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia.
Dean. So, you know, yeah. When I meet a dean, I want to call her Dean as well, but you already told me to call you Lauren.
No, please.
So
please.
I will call you Lauren
That's
as
right.
well, even though you are high and mighty.
No. Not so, but and certainly not by comparison with my colleague here. But just to say a few words, I've not been entirely confined to the ivory tower. I spent a year as a U.S. Supreme Court fellow. I was actually the fellow at the U.S. Sentencing Commission. And way back early in my career, spent a year working for the Senate Judiciary Committee as an American Political Science Association congressional fellow.
So you've gotten your feet wet, or should I say your hands dirty? Because, of course, politics, we know, is a dirty,
That's right.
dirty business.
Sure.
But before your academic career, then you went out and actually did some practical stuff as
That's
well.
Right.
And
That's
in
right.
fact, most of your academic work is built on that, right?
Yeah. So my scholarly work has focused on Congress and the courts, sometimes separately. Within the Congress, I tend to study the Senate. And so I've also then looked at kind of the nexus of Congress and the courts through the appointment process, and in particular, the Senate confirmation process for federal judges. So I haven't been on the federal bench, but I have some idea about how the judges get there.
I see. Very, very good. Well, that's a very nice segue into why the two of you are here, sitting with me in the Potter Studios at Montpelier. You're here for something called a summit, aren't you?
That's correct.
And the summit, of course, is what I refer to as the signature event at the Center for the Constitution, sort of the gold standard in terms of what the center does. We have lots of programs and lots of great online courses, and I've helped to set up a couple of those, and I encourage people to go to the website, montpelier.org, and the center's part of that website, and sign up for those courses. But this is the best experience, and so if you have the opportunity to participate in one of these summits, that's the best thing to do. What is this particular summit about?
Well, so what the summits do generally, because I think it's probably worth starting with what the summits do, we bring together young professionals from Washington, D.C., primarily working either in government itself and ideally inside the Congress, or working with the Congress through an external organization or maybe even a federal agency. And the goal of bringing those young people together is to give them an opportunity in a nonpartisan setting, because, of course, we know most of their work is not going to be done in that way, in a nonpartisan setting to talk about kind of first principles, constitutional principles, and also to think about how those might apply to what they're doing now and how they can help to translate those back to their colleagues and to the people that they encounter in their daily work. So our goal is to bring this very diverse group of young people together and kind of leave their partisan labels at the door, leave their ideologies at the door, and just really have conversations for the weekend about what it means to be Americans, what it means to have the type of government that we have, and what we all have an obligation to do as far as making our government work better. So that's what we're doing here.
So to remind them why they started along this path in the first place.
Yeah, okay. I hope so.
What about you, Judge? What part are you going to play in this summit?
Well, that remains to be seen, I suppose, but I want to follow on Lauren's comment. I think the quiet, reflective retreat atmosphere is so different from the daily experience of Capitol Hill-oriented young professionals that it provides a great opportunity for them to learn in a new way, to learn to listen better to people with different or even opposing points of view than they may encounter in their normal life. So hopefully they will go back more effective, more able to steer the country in a productive direction. And there's no greater investment that the three of us could be making with our time and energy today than trying to forward that goal.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you on that one. People tend to throw their hands up these days and say there's just no point. People don't talk to each other anymore. But having had the pleasure of doing one of these summits about a year ago, it was a remarkable experience. And you're right. You mentioned the retreat atmosphere here, which reminds me that just a few moments ago, as we were standing in the lobby here in the new building at the Center for the Constitution, that the physical environment, I think, is part of that as well. You look out across the duck pond, and you see the ducks moving across it, and you see the reeds in the background swaying in the wind, even in February now. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to get mad at people in that environment. Well, what are your presentations going to be about? I see that you've got a jam-packed weekend ahead of you, so what are you going to be talking about?
Well, Lauren Bell taught one of these seminars, I like to call it, rather than summit. Summit sounds like an arms control meeting or something. but she has already taught a comparable group of young professionals from Washington, and she's put together a terrific curriculum, which we're using with very little alteration. So I'm basically her understudy to do a second edition of your program.
He's too modest. But we so about a year ago as well, I participated in one of these, and Aaron Delaney from Northwestern Law School and I put together the program originally. And when we did this, we thought, you know, we ought to focus it around kind of the functions of Congress. And when I teach Congress, I talk about four functions. Most textbooks talk about three. But those are representation, lawmaking, legitimizing the system of government, so connecting people back to their government, and then serving the people. And so we wanted to really focus the weekend. Again, this was last year, but in our consultations, we talked about kind of replicating that. We wanted to focus around, you know, this is how the system was designed, and these are the functions that Congress and government are supposed to fulfill. So how are we doing? And let's kind of do a little bit of a health check and see. So we start with, of course, with Madison. We're at his home. We start with Federalist 10 this afternoon. And our readings cover a wide range of everything from Supreme Court cases to scholarly articles to popular press articles. We're going to talk a little bit about kind of Congress as the do-nothing Congress and, you know, kind of contemporary reflections on how well our institutions are functioning. So it really, we do span about 225 years as we look at this curriculum, and we do it really fast in like 2 days.
Stuart, it's such a rich mix of history, political science, law, constitutionalism, and I think the focus on Congress is particularly timely and appropriate. Most of our fellow citizens seem to have a very slim idea of what Congress is, what it does, what it's supposed to do, how it can work, how it has worked, how it doesn't sometimes work. And it's such a critical part of the government. As the recent election campaign revealed, and you see it in many press comments made by citizens and others, a lot of people act as if a new president, whoever it may be, just gets to wave his hand and the law is changed. And of course, with the exception of limited areas where executive orders, at least for the executive branch, can set new rules, everything else has to be approved by the Congress. Mm-hmm. So the president is important, the president is powerful, that's always true. But in the end, if you had to pick one branch that is really in charge of America, I would say it's the Congress.
Mm-hmm. It's the first branch of government mentioned in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It was arguably, in some sense, our very first branch because, of course, we came together in the First and Second Continental Congresses. And then when we had our Articles of Confederation, Congress was essentially the only branch of government. That didn't work out too well. We do need that judiciary occasionally, and executives are nice to have as well. But yeah, in many senses, I think the Congress is the most fundamental branch of our government. In fact, to go back a little bit further, on the 400th anniversary of the founding of Virginia at Jamestown, I had the honor of making a presentation to the Speaker of the House of Delegates, Delegate Howell. I think he's still in there.
He is. He just announced his retirement, actually.
Yes, yeah. I think so. And a couple of other members about it. And so I went back and looked at the original Jamestown charters. And guess what? They basically formed a Congress. Of course, they eventually called it a House of Burgesses and then you know, ultimately the House of Delegates or the General Assembly today. But that is the most fundamental part of our three branches of government. So I'm glad you're focused upon it. So what's the consensus as you go into these things, into this summit? Do people agree with the general idea out there that Congress is dysfunctional today, or are there differing opinions on that?
Well, I think there's fairly widespread agreement that Congress is dysfunctional. I think certainly among political scientists who study Congress. Of course, you know, academics disagree over the most minor of details, but I think there's consensus that Congress does not function as well as it at least has the potential to function, or at least as it was intended to function. You know, we can certainly disagree over whether we think Congress should do more or do less, and the framers were certainly hesitant of a Congress that could be too quick to act. But I think the consensus is that Congress is not fulfilling the role that it was intended to have in the constitutional system. And one of the things we will talk about as well this weekend, and I neglected to mention it before, is the relationship between Congress and the executive branch. And certainly throughout the 20th century in particular, Congress did a lot of delegating to the executive branch, things that really are powers that the Constitution establishes as being congressional powers. So I think one of the things that we're going to talk to the participants here at the summit this weekend about is, you know, has Congress given away too much? Have they abdicated their responsibilities? Should they do more to take that back? Now, if you're being really cynical, you might say, well, if I'm a member of Congress, I want the executive branch to handle all of this because then they can take the blame. They can deal with all of the difficult questions, and we can take some credit when we help people navigate through the Byzantine structures of the bureaucracy or things like that. So we're going to try to get into all of that because I think those kinds of questions, thinking about what is the proper role of the Congress, how does the Congress and the executive branch interact, and where does the bureaucracy fit, and what did the framers think? All of those questions are really important to understanding governance.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with two very learned people today. Lauren Bell, the professor of political science and dean of academic affairs at Randolph-Macon College, and Paul Michel, a former chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And we're talking all about the separation of powers and Congress. Stick around. Now it's time for our constitutional quiz recorded live at the We the People State Finals held this year at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia, where there's also something called the Center for Politics. And the center has sent over Meg Hubeck to help with this week's constitutional quiz. We're also assisted by David Cash Earhart, the Director of Student Programs at the Sorensen Institute.
Well, now it looks like we have another quiz contestant, a fine-looking young man. He looks like he's ready for battle. Cash, who is this young man?
We are joined by Gavin.
Gavin, how you doing?
Doing good.
Doing good. Where are you from, Gavin?
Brunswick County, home of the Bulldogs.
Brunswick County, I'm guessing your mascot is the Bulldogs?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, can we hear a Bulldog call?
Oh, can we hear a Bulldog call?
All right, Gavin. Very impressive. Okay. Meg, you got a quiz?
I do. How many of the 55 delegates attending the Constitutional Convention actually signed the document? A, 55. B, 39. C, 42, or D, 30.
Can we have those numbers again? This is how many of the 55 delegates who came and went actually signed the Constitution? What were the choices?
155, meaning all of the delegates signed it. B, 39 of the original 55 signed the document. C, 42 of 55 signed the original document. Or D, 30 of the original 55 signed the document.
Gavin, have you polled your classmates there? Okay,
you
what's
said
your answer?
B was 39, right?
You're picking 39 people signed it, actually signed the document. That's how many signatures are on there.
Are you sure?
It's kind of how I'm feeling right now.
It's kind of how he's feeling right now.
I like how you're feeling right now. That is absolutely correct.
Well done.
Thank God, or I would have seemed really dumb.
I'm glad I made these questions so
easy. Good job, good job.
Okay, tremendous.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guests are Lauren Bell, the Dean of Academic Affairs at Randolph-Macon College, and Paul Michel, the former Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And we're talking all about Congress, and specifically how Congress fits in and interacts, or at least is supposed to interact, with the other branches of the national government. The conversation has taken several interesting turns thus far, and just before the break, we were getting to an issue that's of great interest to me, the rise of the administrative state.
Lauren, you've really hit upon something that is one of my pet theories. In fact, I think I'm going to have to write a law review article about it eventually because it's been something that's been bothering me for a long time. I agree with you. I think Congress, or I agree with that idea, that Congress may have simply given away too much. And I think this goes back over 100 years. I think when we started creating agencies that went beyond a purely executive function and started delegating powers to agencies that span all three functions of government. We were talking about rulemaking before. Maybe we've given too much rulemaking power to too many agencies because that's effectively legislating. And then that same agency that makes the law then prosecutes the law, enforces the law. That's the executive function and arguably the only legitimate function of an executive agency. And then, of course, the one that really gets me is they adjudicate the law with all of these administrative law judges and these so-called quasi-judicial functions, which theoretically are reviewable by courts like yours, Judge, but as we all know, are deferred to such a great extent that effectively they're the end of the process. That just troubles me because I very much believe in the separation of powers and the three branches of government. I wonder if do you share that concern, either of you?
Well, I think we have to renumber because there are at least four branches of government. As you mentioned, the plethora of administrative agencies and departmental units that issue regulations, adjudicate disputes, interpret the law, really is a fourth branch of government, mm-hmm. as distinct from the executive and the Congress and the courts as could be. And as you point out, they've been deferred to so much, not only by the Congress, and in many respects by administrations, if by that we mean the White House, mm-hmm. but also massively deferred to, maybe excessively deferred to by the courts. As you know, the famous Chevron right. case has taken on a life of its own, so that now courts pretty much rubber stamp almost any interpretation of the law that a given agency comes up with, which seems to me to be an inappropriate divestiture of the judicial function. Congress passes the law, the court's supposed to say what it means.
Exactly.
Not some agency, the court.
Yeah, exactly. Judge, I like you. I like people like you. I like people like you who get nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and then you have immunity from the pressures that all human beings have in terms of your livelihood. The Constitution says that while you're in office, you can't be removed as long as you retain good behavior, which is a fairly easy standard. And moreover, your salary can't even be reduced. Now, some would argue, well, gosh, that's more job security than any human being should have. I feel exactly the opposite. I feel that's the point at which somebody like you, and you can jump in here and correct me if I'm wrong, it feels completely free now to do his or her job and do it fully. In a nutshell, I think really, the more I think about it, the more I'm going to have to do this. I think that we could fix the problem of this fourth branch of government fairly simply. Instead of allowing agencies to make these rules through a rulemaking process, which Congress rarely intercedes in, have them make recommendations to Congress and make those congressmen vote on
it. But that's where I was going to jump in, Stuart. I think that the real challenge is that if you look at the political incentives for members of Congress, in particular thinking about the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, I was just having this conversation with a former student of mine who's been offered a legislative affairs position in the new administration and is on the fence about whether to take it. You know, I think there's not a lot of incentive for members of the House to want to weigh in on difficult questions like that. So it's a lot easier to say, well, let's let these administrative agencies make these choices, because then if they do something really extreme, we could step in.
Yeah.
But if we have to make those decisions, or if we have to receive all of these recommendations, we're on the hook. Those votes, those roll call votes, are then public record. They can be used by lobbyists. They can be used by pressure groups against us when we run for re-election. And hey, guess what? That's, you know, in N minus 2 years, right? I mean, they have such a short window of time. So the politics of that, for members of Congress, it's much better politically to defer to these agencies.
Translation, Lauren, they're a bunch of damn cowards.
Well, I didn't say that,
I feel like that's Congress's job. I want those guys to be under pressure. I want those guys to have to consider these things and do their job. That's an interesting phrase these days. We have a lot of citizens who are very angry right now, and I'm not taking sides, but to do their jobs, to actually make the law. And now you've solved that problem. Now you don't have agencies legislating. Well, if you want enforcement powers, okay, I think that's probably the proper role of a lot of agencies, as long as it's done properly, perhaps through the Department of Justice. And then finally, if there's a dispute, for heaven's sake, we go to a real judge, an Article III judge who makes a real decision that's really binding. Do you think that's doable, Judge? Could we do something like that?
Let me start by commenting about the extremely powerful tenure that federal judges have with the lifetime appointment. Mm-hmm. I think it's very valuable, and it promotes independent decision making. But in a way, although necessary, it's still an evil. It's a necessary evil. You have to have it to have independence. But it creates a risk of judges becoming legislators themselves, just like regulatory agencies are at risk of becoming legislators. So I think it's good we have it. I wish the state judges had more of the kind of strong tenure protections that federal judges have. But it's not an unalloyed, problem-free mechanism. As to the dysfunction of Congress, it seems to me that the first and foremost evidence of dysfunction is they almost never pass a budget in recent years.
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
In the Constitution, it's clear that in addition to making the substantive laws through enacting statutes, the Congress is obligated to fund the functions of the government, to appropriate the money. And they don't do it. And I just think it's an outrageous dereliction of duty on their part. And in terms of ducking the hard problems facing the society, not only should they answer the hard questions, they almost have to for the answers to be acceptable to any large portion of the public. Because if the public is not happy, that congressman or senator can be unelected in the next election. But if they don't make any of the hard decisions, and some faceless bureaucrat in some agency or some judge they've never heard of or some other actor makes these hard calls, then how much legitimacy do they have in the eyes of the people whose lives are affected by those decisions? So I think it's very important for the credibility of a democratic government for the legislators to take the responsibility to live or die with the consequences. One of the problems, I think, may be that we've turned what used to be a sidelight for a citizen, a part-time job, if you will, in the early part of the country's history, into a full-time, lifetime career. So they're so focused on, can I raise enough money to scare away a primary opponent to almost guarantee I'll get reelected time after time after time and stay in Congress endlessly? It might be better to go back to the tradition of people in and out whose main job was something else. University professor, practicing lawyer, or whatever, and let them serve in Congress for a while and then go back to normal life, so to speak. So I think we really need to rethink who we want in Congress as well as what is their job.
Very, very important things.
So you're in favor of term limits then?
I used to be totally against it because I was convinced by the argument that, well, there are term limits in the hands of the voters. They can mm-hmm. kick out anybody they want any time. But through gerrymandering and fundraising and the lack of control of campaign finances, the reality is they can't be kicked out anytime somebody is dissatisfied with their performance. So I'm for a form of term limits. I don't really have it worked out. But one of the things I would like to see, and this very much speaks to the future of the young people that Professor Bell and I will be talking with over the next 2 days, I think I'd like to see age limits, including for judges. I think it's very important to have a constant turnover, infusion of new ideas, new, young, energetic, ambitious people. It shouldn't be age 50, in my opinion, now that I'm 76, I'm sensitive to this. But at some point, there should be a cutoff, whether it's judges or bishops or university presidents or members of Congress, because when people stay too long in the same job, a lot of bad things start to happen.
Well, I've actually, excuse me for interrupting, I've actually spoken with one fellow who suggested for term limits, long ones, for the judiciary, 20, 25 years, something of that sort, similar theory. But I interrupted you, Lauren.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm totally opposed to term limits. So, and I'm opposed to that from my both my congressional scholarship and also some of the state legislative work that I've done. And
how come?
Well, so I think when you impose term limits, and we've seen this in the states that did this, what you end up doing is giving an awful lot of power to unelected staff because the staff don't go away. And in particular, when we think about Congress and the challenges to being able to come into Congress and be effective in a short period of time. So you were talking about the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and knowing the rules is so important. And if you think about the rules for the House of Representatives or even for the U.S. Senate, their rules are significantly smaller, but then everything that happens depends on precedence. In order to learn those to the degree that's needed as a new member of Congress, it does take years. And so when new members come in, the very first thing that they do is look for seasoned veteran staff members. And in addition to that, those seasoned veteran staff members are asked, make some recommendations for groups we can trust, outside groups that we can trust, who are going to be able to give us the information that we mm-hmm. need. And so if we move in the direction of term limits, and again, Oklahoma is a great example of this. There's been some recent literature about the Oklahoma State Legislature and about the loss of expertise from members because Oklahoma was one of the early adopters of term limits back in 1994, I think. And they've progressively seen pretty much every measure of legislative effectiveness slide since the first group of legislators were term limited out. I mean, I think what you see then is unelected staff and lobbyists who end up gaining even more authority in a system where the legislators know they're term limited. Mm-hmm. And you're also more likely to see progressive ambition from those legislators. In other words, I can't stay in the House of Representatives for my entire career, so I better start thinking about a Senate run, or I better start thinking about running for governor. In the meantime, what you do then is those members leave. They take their personal expertise. They leave their staff. And those staff, there's nothing you can, we don't even know who they are, right? And so, I mean, we're in a situation now where I think the last number I saw is across Capitol Hill, there's something like 57 staff members to every single member of Congress when you include all of the support staff.
Yeah.
So to remove the elected legislators who are the ones actually casting those votes and who do have to be electorally responsive. And I've done some work on the ouster of Eric Cantor by my former colleague Dave Brad. I mean, there's an example where there is a limit to how far you can push constituents before they say enough is enough.
And so what's the solution?
Well, I mean, I think constituents have to hold their representatives accountable. I actually think, again, you know, we're not talking about partisan politics here, but I've actually been encouraged by what I've seen as the demands by constituents that their members hold town hall meetings and that they hold public town halls, because there's been a trend in the last few years for members to hold sort of invitation-only town halls. And of course, you want to make sure that those town halls are secure and that the member is physically safe. But I think we, the people, have to start insisting that our members are accountable to us. And, you know, if you look at turnout rates in congressional elections, they're abysmal.
Right? Yeah, they are.
In the 30% ranges in many instances. And so if people are not going to take the time to go and cast a vote, whether for or against the incumbent, then, you know, we're not likely to see a whole lot of that change.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm out at Montpelier speaking with two really interesting people, Paul Michel, who is a former chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and Lauren C. Bell, who's a professor of political science and dean of academic affairs at Randolph-Macon College. Our subject is Congress, and specifically how Congress fits in to the other branches of the national government, how it works with them. And we've come inevitably to the subject of voting, and how it gets rather discouraging and perhaps dysfunctional when people don't exercise the franchise. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Paul and Lauren. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our conversation with Lauren C. Bell and Paul Michel, all about Congress and the functioning of our political system. We'd gotten to the subject of how difficult and perhaps discouraging it is to have a political system function when people simply don't participate. And indeed, I've had some experience myself in that regard.
Years ago, when I was involved in electoral politics, supporting a candidate for a local office, I was asked for my comment after my candidate lost. And without much forethought, I blurted out, the people have spoken and they've said, we don't care.
Yeah.
Because there was something like 15% turnout.
Right.
And when 85%
right.
of people, and that's just registered voters, remember, that's not
that's
everybody.
Right.
That's just the people who bothered to register. When 85% of them don't even turn out, the people have spoken, we don't care. That's very, very troubling.
And of those who did register and turn out and did vote, what percentage had any foundational knowledge of what their member had done or not done?
Yep. How many of them actually did their homework? I often say I'm not in favor of voting. I'm in favor of informed voting. And that's the next great challenge.
Nicely put. You know, another problem in Congress now is that the expertise that takes years to develop is so important, as Lauren was pointing out. But another problem is just time allocation. When I was a staffer at the Senate in the early 80s, the senator I worked for spent about 90% of his time being a legislator and 10% of his time being a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. I'm now told, I think quite reliably, that that has almost inverted, and that members spend the majority of their time raising money and doing other things directly related to raising money, and a minority of their time legislating. That can't be a healthy system with that kind of time allocation.
Well,
we have to change that.
How do you feel about campaign finance reform then? In fact, that seems to be a common theme here, is that these legislators are under pressure to get reelected, pressure to raise money. Therefore, they abdicate their powers. Therefore, they're afraid to make tough decisions. Therefore, they simply don't have time to do their jobs.
I'm a huge proponent of public financing of campaigns, and that makes me very unpopular with lots of people. But if you look at other systems around the world where public financing of legislative campaigns take place, you don't have these issues of money in politics. And I mean, I would make the argument that a free and honest campaign is essential to democracy, and it is in the public interest. So I'm a big proponent of that. Campaign finance reform, the challenge you have, right, is either it's like the fox guarding the hen house, you have to rely on Congress to reform their own rules about campaign finance, or you have to wait until questions make their way through the courts. And that's an example to me where I'm meaning no disrespect, I'm not sure the courts are particularly well-suited to handle those questions.
Yeah, Paul, you guys have really messed this up, all this First Amendment stuff.
I'm going to say Congress, I think, has really messed this up, but I don't think it's reasonable then to put that onto the courts to ask them to resolve.
Well, the courts have basically resolved it saying that money is speech, and they have struck down a lot of campaign finance reform. In fact, I wouldn't say all, but certainly some of the most significant stuff, and that's another huge issue.
Right. You know, the system faces a double whammy. On the one hand, raising huge amounts of money has become this super imperative. Members are pressured by their party, whichever party they belong to raise a lot of money to be sure to get reelected. Most districts are so heavily gerrymandered that they're safe districts for the one party or the other. Therefore, if I'm a member, my only worry is, do I have a strong primary opponent? Because if I win my primary, I'm going to win the general election with no contest. So a strong opponent is feared. So what do? They raise huge amounts of early money. That scares away the strong opponent. So we have a Congress that has a 10% approval rating. As Lauren says, they like their own congressman, but they don't like all the others. But in general, 10% approval rating, but a 90%+ retention rate. So there's something wrong here with the approval and the retention statistics being so completely the opposite.
You know, I wonder, and I'm looking at Lauren now because you're the scholar here, I wonder if that really is a modern trend, that liking one's own representative and disliking the institution, if that's really modern, or if that's an almost inevitable part of a democratic system, a majoritarian system, because, of course, it's likely, at least, that I like the person in my district because a majority of people in my district voted for that person. But those other people represent different constituencies. Is this just a fundamental problem of majoritarian systems that you just dislike people who vote against you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is fairly fundamental. I don't think there's anything new or particularly modern about that. I mean, I think we have a tendency in politics to talk about things as if they're a zero-sum game, right? So if my district gets some benefit, then that must mean Paul's district is losing something, even though the benefits might be specific, but the harms are much more diffuse than that. I think it is sort of endemic to the system that we have. And, of course, when we talk about the 90% retention, that's based on the individual election results for members of Congress versus 10% approval, which is, of course, at the macro level looking at widespread public opinion. So it's really hard to compare those things. I think we're seeing a little bit of a change, right? I mean, I mentioned the sort of constituents who are now starting to say, like, hey, wait a second, Congress is kind of important here. I think that's something at least that is encouraging to me. If there's more citizen participation, members are going to have to pay more attention. But I also think, and I go back to the Eric Cantor and Dave Brat example, you know, nobody thought Dave Brat had a chance. And in fact, when you're talking about gerrymandering, I think if we could fix one thing in our politics today, if we could fix gerrymandering, if we could move nationally to nonpartisan redistricting commissions, that would just have a tremendous ripple effect in a positive way throughout our entire political system. But if you go back to that Brat Cantor, I mean, Cantor had gerrymandered that district to be so safe for him. He was never going to be challenged by a Democrat. And in fact, even with some adjustments, a Democrat can't win the 7th district. I mean, I'm sorry to any Democrats out there who think that the 7th is really in play. It's not. And so he was challenged, but he was challenged by a guy who had like $150,000, right? And Cantor has $8 million. And so I think that actually gives me some hope as well, because what it says is that money is not sufficient necessarily. Being the majority leader of the House of Representatives is not sufficient. If you are not connecting with your constituents, if you are not making them a priority, I mean, my favorite image from that whole Cantor race is that Cantor on his congressional webpage has a picture of him Skyping with high school students in his district, which, of course, is 90 miles away. Right? So he's not a California member or something where Skype makes sense. Get on the flipping train, right? Come down, visit a high school or two. It's not going to take you any more than half a day. But that demonstrated the disconnect. And I think what has happened is that members have for years relied on those low turnout rates, the lack of attentiveness within the public. And what's starting to happen now, and that's why I'm somewhat encouraged, is that people are saying, hey, wait a second, look what happens when we don't pay attention.
I totally agree. The public at large has to get angry with the poor performance of their government.
I think you got that one happening, Judge.
And I think we do have it happening, and I'm actually kind of hopeful that sooner or later a lot of good will come out of this, because the status quo of the last 20 or 30 years is not satisfactory, not healthy, not sustainable. So even if the current scene is a little disruptive and unpredictable and has risks and dangers, which I think it probably does, I'm still kind of encouraged, because at least a lot of people are getting involved. A lot of people who are going to town meetings now, when they're interviewed, turn out that they have never gone before. This is the first town meeting. And I completely agree with Lauren. Publicly accessible town meetings are the single most important legislator-citizen interaction. Not ads on TV, not free, franked letters supposedly reporting on what I'm doing in Congress, but it's really campaign literature about what a great guy I am and why you should reelect me. So
what do you think about these people who are refusing to go to their own town meetings now, these representatives?
Well, you mentioned cowards, right? And I think that, I think that is unconscionable. And the other thing I think that it's unconscionable is the talking point that the people who are attending are just paid protesters or paid agitators.
That's really interesting you should say that. I was listening to All Things Considered this morning, because I'm driving out to Montpelier, and they were interviewing, I think his name is Chaffetz, the fellow
Jason
from Utah,
Chaffetz,
right?
Mm-hmm.
He's the head of the House, Committee on Investigations or something of that sort. And he had made the claim that the people coming to his particular district were all a bunch of outside agitators. So they actually had reporters go in and ask them where they were from, and it turned out they were from his district. But when he was confronted with that, he was still saying, well, I'm not sure.
No, in fact, the two people who were mentioned in the story, I think it was on Huffington Post, are actually friends of a friend of mine. And so who were saying, like, well, if we are being paid, we haven't seen this money. Where is this money? That I find absolutely unconscionable, because what that is intended to do is it is intended to discount the energy and activism of individual citizens. I also think it's going to backfire on these members. I think, the absolute worst thing you can do is demonstrate to your constituents that you just don't care about them. And so, you know, I've seen no evidence. Are there potentially paid protesters out there? I don't know, but I've seen no evidence of it. When people are interviewed, when you look at who's in the crowd, these seem to be people who live in the district.
Know. Evidence, facts, I don't know if those are part of the discourse anymore. Hey, look, this is fascinating, and we've been focusing on Congress because that's what you're focusing on in this summit. And we could talk all day about this. But I think one other very important thing we need to talk about now, and we need to take advantage of the fact that we have a former United States District Court of Appeals judge here with us, is to talk about the judiciary, because there has been a lot of talk out there, and I'm not going to name names, but most of it emanates from the executive branch, referring to so-called judges, perhaps so-called courts. A lot of chatter on the internet about the courts have no business reviewing the president's executive orders when it comes to immigration, for example, which is very much in the news. I'll just put my cards on the table. Simply as a lawyer, as a law professor, as someone who cares about the Constitution, I find that very, very troubling, because we do have three branches of government, and the judiciary is an extremely important one. And I'm going to guess, just take a wild guess, that the two of you are going to agree with me broadly on that. Judge?
Well, the independence is critical, and the credibility is critical. And since judges are not elected and aren't subject to being kicked out under any normal circumstances, their credibility has to depend on the quality of their work and their written opinions and their decision-making as assessed by other people. But it also has to depend to a great degree on how they're referred to by other political actors. So if a congressman or a regulator or a president or any other actor slurs judges, it destroys the credibility of all judges. So even if you imagine some circumstance where severe criticism maybe was justified, it's still a terrible thing, because it puts a blight on all judges and therefore the acceptability, the credibility of the work of any and every judge. So it's a very unfortunate thing, and it's unfortunately only one example of the absolutely toxic political discourse that has become dominant in this country. And if we can't turn back away from that, I don't see how we're ever going to accommodate the divergent interests and needs of so diverse a society.
Lauren?
You know, I think what I really appreciate about the courts is that it's the only branch where they're totally transparent in their decision making, right? I mean, you know, people say, well, you can watch Congress on C-SPAN or, you know, the president gives press conferences. But then, you know, they turn the cameras off and the hard decisions and the substantive decisions happen behind closed doors or you know, in the dark. I mean, judges and courts, they make these decisions and they put them in writing. And the Supreme Court will say it doesn't really matter what our actual decision is. Read the opinion. What we've written there is the most important thing. There's no other branch that provides that degree of explanation and transparency about how they reached the decision that they reached. And so this notion that somehow judges are waving a magic wand and making a decision that is just something that they prefer, I find that absurd because it's all right there. It's all spelled out.
Well, not only does the opinion in every case explain the result and the reasoning that got to the result, but it's also based on a limited record that other people can go and look at, newspaper reporters and scholars and others, and the judges are not allowed to go outside of that record. A president or a congressman or other actors could have secret meetings by the hundreds and be making a decision based on those secret meetings, and no one would ever know because they're secret.
Judges are restricted. Judges can't even talk to lawyers on their cases.
That's correct.
I mean, that's an extremely important point. It's a closed universe, and all of it's done in public. So if you want to know not just what the judge has decided, not just what the rationale for the judge is, read the opinion, but even all the inputs, all the people the judge talked to or heard from, it's right there on the record. So thank you for making that point, because I don't think a lot of people realize that.
You know, new judges are told, you used to be a lawyer, as virtually all of us were, and you have a lot of friends at the bar because you've tried cases with them or against them or know them in professional settings, conferences, and so forth. None of your friends will call you anymore.
Right.
As soon as you're on the bench, you're going to be isolated. When I was sworn in by the first chief judge of the Federal Circuit in 1988, the first thing he said after he put down the Bible was, in this gravelly, wonderful voice he had, "Welcome to the monastery."
One last thing about the court specifically. It's just the very concept of judicial review. If you go all the way back to Marbury versus Madison in 1803, the famous quote from John Marshall, it's emphatically the province and the duty of the judicial branch to say what the law is. Here's an example. That's kind of highfalutin language. What exactly does that mean? It's engraved on his bust, okay, in the Supreme Court. That's great. I always translate it thusly. This is what judges do.
Well, I want to just jump in a little bit on that and go back to your original point when you asked about, you know, critics claiming that judges shouldn't have the authority to do this. I mean, as you're kind of describing Marshall and his famous words in Marbury versus Madison, I mean, that's also what Federalist Number 78 says, right? I mean, that's what the framers, this is what the framers of the Constitution intended for the courts to do. They intended for the courts to look at actions of government or laws passed by Congress and determine whether or not they met the constitutional standard. And in the event that they didn't, then it was the job of the courts to say so. And I think to have anybody of any political persuasion suggest that the courts have no right to do these things, again, I'd use the word unconscionable.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Paul Michel, the former chief judge of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and to Lauren Bell, the Dean of Academic Affairs at Randolph-Macon College and a professor of political science there who studies Congress. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.